This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The Champions League. Did Ole find one of Sir Alex's old hairdryers at half-time? Manchester United come back from two down to beat Atalanta. Ronaldo with a trademark towering header to seal an undeserved but kind of deserved victory by this very strange football team. What does it all mean? And are any of the panel either prepared to praise Ole Gunnar Solskjaer because, well, it was a good comeback, or criticise him because they met him once and he was lovely? Elsewhere, a victory for Chelsea but at a cost. Lukaku and Werner forced off. We'll round up the rest of the Champions League. There's also a great comeback for Leicester in the Europa League. Meanwhile, Steve Bruce has left Newcastle by one of those mutual consents. We'll look ahead to the Premier League weekend. We've got exciting Kevin Keegan awards ceremony news, more on carpets and teapots, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Johnny Liu, hello.
Hi, it's really disgustingly early, so I'm still in my pyjamas. What's the meaning of this?
Well, it's 8:45 in the UK, Johnny.
Too early.
And are they pyjamas?
They're pyjamas.
Oh, you look sort of in just general casual wear, I'd suggest. When do you want us to start? Do you want us to wait for 15 minutes? Or since we're here, should we carry on? What would you rather?
I'm here now, but I'm here under protest. I just want to lodge that protest, put that on the record.
Okay, no, noted. Absolutely right. Nicky Bandini, are you happy with the time? Or are you also, is there anything you'd like to protest about?
I don't mind the time. I am still wearing pyjama bottoms. So, yeah, okay. You know, we're definitely at that stage of the day. After a Champions League round, Max, you know, okay, evening finish that goes on and then you get an early start.
And Barry, are you wearing anything on the bottom half, or are you as normal pod, top, no bottoms?
I have been up for 3 hours. I'm showered, fully dressed. I've been out for a walk. I'm thoroughly prepared.
What a pro. Let's start with Manchester United's win over Atalanta. NPR says, are the other 19 Premier League teams the biggest winners of Manchester United's comeback against Atalanta? Hashtag save OGS. It was a great game and a great comeback, and one, Barry, that weirdly felt kind of inevitable despite how bad Manchester United and how good Atalanta were in the first half.
Did it seem inevitable? It didn't seem inevitable to me at half time, but it was a terrific game. I really enjoyed it. And for all the criticism Ole Gunnar Solskjaer gets, I think Manchester United fans who, you know, we need to remember football is, it's the entertainment business. Fans pay a lot of money to go to these games, ideally to win trophies, but first and foremost to be entertained. And if you're a Manchester United fan at the moment, you are certainly being entertained. And The Jose Mourinho era feels a very long time ago when they were just having to watch absolute dreck. I thought they were quite lucky to win. They relied on moments of individual brilliance. On paper, they should be beating Atalanta all the time because they have better players. I don't think this match is one that Ollie supporters can look at and sit, tell us detractors that we were all wrong. But yeah, they deserve credit for coming from two goals behind to win a game 3-2 in a right rollicking, chaotic fashion.
Johnny, is Barry right there that it's sort of moments of individual brilliance, and this is the team that loosely doesn't seem to have any tactics, and if they do have tactics, it's really, do they plav McFred or not McFred, and if they do or they don't, that doesn't seem to matter anyway.
Yeah, I thought it was a perfectly fair result, to be honest. The 2-0 at halftime wasn't really a fair kind of reflection, I think, of the chances that they had. I mean, United did have a lot of chances in the first half as well. So, you know, and then the second half, they just kind of absolutely stormed the gates. You know, on what Barry says about like entertainment, and, you know, does it matter that they don't have a tactical plan, or, you know, does it matter that the kind of the midfield still looks really understaffed? And I kind of wonder, you know, we're moving into this era where the modern football club, certainly United, kind of sees itself as, if you think of it as like a rolling content machine, like a long-running TV show, all this kind of stuff makes total sense. Does it really matter if, you know, if they don't win a trophy? Probably not in the end. Like, the thing about The Simpsons was that, like, the big joke that was that, you know, they were always striving for something, but at the end of the episode, everything basically goes back to the way it was. And that's kind of how United are. You know, there's a way of interpreting the last 3 years as, like, just totally, totally perfect from an entertainment business point of view, because they pull off these incredible comebacks, and there's this will they, won't they storyline, you know, surrounding, you know, the manager and transfers, and there's all this kind of intrigue and all these celebrity cameos, and it's worth considering, like, what exactly it is they want. Clearly, from the point of view of you know, the business, last night was great.
Were you just expecting sort of, you know, Ted Danson to walk in and everybody applauds, and then they just carry on with the second half for a bit, and then it's just someone else? It's that kind of, it's no longer a football team.
It's very Roy of the Rovers. Like, last night felt very Roy of the Rovers, and it actually put me in mind of Scott Murray ages ago wrote a piece for The Guardian about his thesis. I think it was for The Guardian, wrote it somewhere, about why England don't win, which is that England is obsessed with Roy of the Rovers football, where you've got to score the amazing goal at the end and make it a sort of beautiful story. I mean, this is back in the time when England weren't reaching international finals that they did this summer. For Ronaldo to score the last goal after everything as well, as a narrative, it was brilliant.
Is that what Ronaldo was doing for Juventus? I mean, because I was watching that game thinking, you can't take Rashford off. He's missed those chances, but he's scored and he's getting chances. Ronaldo is ostensibly doing nothing. And this is the time for Solskjaer to be brave and say, Cristiano, this isn't your game. Off you come. And yet it was just like a sort of textbook towering header that was just so perfectly Ronaldo. Is that what he was doing at Juventus?
To an extent, yeah. I think Ronaldo at Juventus was, the goals were always there. The goals were there in extraordinary numbers. And that was kind of what he gave you last night. He gave you a goal. And frankly, a striker who doesn't contribute much but can guarantee you a goal, it's still pretty useful for most teams to have that if you really feel confident he's going to show up with that goal. Now, the issue that Juventus had with him is that in his early time there, he kept showing up with those goals in the Champions League. Last season, he really didn't. And that was kind of, I think, almost where the disconnect came was, well, if you're doing this and you're still at least giving us those big goals in the big occasions, it's great. But the big occasions didn't happen so much for Ronaldo last season. So yeah, that definitely that has been a mode he's been in for a little while, I think.
The criticism that Solskjaer got after the Young Boys game, the first group game where they lost 2-1, was that Solskjaer could have, he took Ronaldo off and he took Bruno Fernandes off and invited pressure. So, you know, it clearly suits them far more to be playing on the front foot like that, certainly against the weaker opposition.
There was a key double save from De Gea in this game, Nicky, at 2-1, where you think that would have put it to bed. And I don't know, at the time I felt like that's what Atalanta deserved. But listening to Johnny, maybe I'm wrong to think that.
Look, I think deserve is just sort of strange way of framing it. We all do this in football, like, and I do it as well. But when you look at this game, do I feel like maybe Atalanta deserves something? Well, I want to say yes, because Atalanta showed up for this game missing basically their entire defence, right? They were missing two starting centre-backs in Toloi and Jim City. They were missing both of their starting wing-backs in Hatabur and Gosens. And then Demiral, who was their best remaining defender, so you're talking about a back five in effect with the wing-backs and the centre-backs, their best remaining defender goes off at half-time. So the fact that they gave anything like this sort of difficulty to a Manchester United team who pay huge, many multiples of what their total salary is that they're paying, to come close to that kind of result, to continue playing with the courage they did, not that it's a surprise to anyone anymore that this is how Atalanta play, but to continue playing with the courage at 2-0 up and even at 2-1 up to then create that chance at 2-1. And it was a great chance. Zapata, absolutely brilliant piece of sort of body movement and footwork to get around the defender and create that shot for himself. Malinovsky, someone who I, in those situations, edge of the area, I can think of a few players actually who I would pick ahead of him for that sort of shot. He's very good at those. I think they sort of, their courage, yes, and their sort of approach was really admirable. Do I think that on the balance of chances and XG and all of those things that they deserved a result? I don't know. I think by the end, the holes in that defence, the tiredness of the team were pretty badly exposed, and United had a lot of chances as well.
I really enjoyed Demiral scoring that header and feeling his hammy. And then about 5 minutes later, absolutely sprinting back to catch Marcus Rashford on one of those chances. You're thinking, if you've only got one hamstring, that's going to be incredibly sore tomorrow, mate.
And he celebrated that so like enthusiastically as well, that tackle. It was a, you could tell he's been spending time before this season with Chiellini at Juventus, can't you? That's that sort of celebration.
Yeah, totally. A few people asking about Solskjaer and what this means for United, and Dermot saying if United are papering over the cracks to this extent, at what point do they switch to plaster? And after this many apparent cracks, at what point can Ole blame the building regulations? Michael, given how much United spend papering over cracks, how long until they're just papering over paper? You get this feeling that they are not going to challenge. They've got so many brilliant players, perhaps they don't have a balanced squad, but they're not going to take the next step with Solskjaer. But he always does enough to not get sacked. So it's just sort of an endless cycle.
It certainly doesn't matter right now. I mean, certainly all the noises coming out of, you know, the hierarchy is that they are very much behind Solskjaer. And, you know, United have kind of shown their hand over the last few years in terms of they don't get rid of managers until they fall out of the top four. That's essentially the baseline expectation. And if United is still, you know, second or third, going into, you know, and possibly even finish, you know, in, you know, third or fourth in the table, there's a very good chance that Solskjaer will stay because he's kind of fulfilled the business brief. And on, you know, taking a longer term view, you know, you might say, well, they have spent all this money, but, you know, City are so good, Chelsea are so good, Liverpool are so good right now. And maybe, you know, when maybe Guardiola leaves and Klopp leaves in a couple of years, maybe that's the opportunity for them. And they've kind of identified that as the time to really have a big push for it. And in the meantime, if Solskjaer can keep them ticking over and keep the product fresh, then maybe it's not such the, you know, maybe it's not the worst thing for them.
Peter says, I'd love Football Weekly's thoughts on pundits refusing to criticise managers' teams because of a connection to them. Should Neville, Scholes, etc. not report on Manchester United games because they clearly can't be objective? They're paid to give insight. They're not doing their job. I mean, Paul Scholes on BT was incredibly annoyed by United's victory at full-time and said they lack unity, would have been taken apart by a better team than Atalanta. Well, this weekend they have Liverpool. But I saw Barney saying, look, it's all right if you're mates with someone, but then you just don't take the money, just don't go to work that evening.
Well, I don't necessarily agree. You can be critical of your mate without calling for him to be fired. And I wouldn't call for a mate to be fired if I thought he was a good job because he's my mate. But I can still be critical of the job he's doing. And I have an occasion being critical of the job you do, Max. I would never call for you to be fired. I don't think you should be fired. I think you do a great job most of the time. But I totally understand why Gary Neville won't call for, or Roy Keane won't call for Ollie to be fired. But I watched Gary Neville on Monday Night Football. He was still critical of Manchester United. He was critical of their tactics. He was critical of the players' attitude. And that's tacit criticism of the manager because the manager is in charge of those players. There is a distinction to be made between criticising your mate and calling for your mate to be fired. Only a total prick would call for his mate to be fired from a job. And I don't understand why people think people should do that. Now, there's a difference again between the kind of criticism Gary Neville or Roy Keane or Paul Scholes leveled at Manchester United, which they have, and someone like Rio Ferdinand being a total shameless cheerleader. See also Robbie Savage on Co-Coms last night. It's just football conversation. It's not that important. You know, lives don't depend on it.
I enjoyed Nicky's, oh God, during...
I really try not to because like live commentary is not an easy thing to do at all. It's hard and I don't want to be critical of anyone, but the Viva Ronaldo made me wince a little bit last night. I couldn't, I don't know, that there was that there's like a line because like this is really common. It's not an English only situation. You follow Italian teams on Italian coverage, and of course it's biased towards the Italian teams. That's how it goes. But there's like a line between being sort of, I don't know, more positive about the home team and and something that just, I don't know. It felt like it tipped over last night. I don't know why for me.
This leads to this kind of almost like an epistemological debate when it comes to what it is actually it is we want from our commentators and our pundits. And, you know, you see this in other forms of commentary as well, whether it's political commentary or arts criticism, should we strive to be impartial, even though we kind of know that we are never going to be impartial and that, you know, we are riddled with cognitive biases? Or is it actually more honest, as, you know, I think people like Gary Neville and, you know, Jamie Carragher have done these days, which is to kind of admit your biases and be really open about them, like tell people where your allegiances lie, and then people can kind of judge what you say through that prism. And, you know, that's kind of a question that journalism is kind of is grappling with on a lot of levels, because this idea that pundits should be totally impartial feels to me like a increasingly outdated, not just outdated, but also an increasingly kind of elusive thing to strive for.
I don't think pundits should be impartial. I think it's totally understandable that a pundit would not publicly call for his friend to lose a job.
Yeah, but there are kind of like degrees of criticism here. So it's not a case of like you're calling for somebody to be fired, you know, or you're not calling for someone to be fired. It's almost like you kind of modulate your criticism a little bit. You maybe don't stick the boot in as hard as you would do if it wasn't your mate. And, you know, that kind of thing, you know, it does have a kind of, if you have allegiances, if you are somebody's mate, that does kind of affect the sort of things you are going to say about someone.
Yeah, that is true. But Gary Neville the other night also made the point that he has never called for any manager to be fired.
He's been consistent on that, to be fair to him.
And I think that's a really common thing, actually, when you talk to ex-pros. I think that's kind of where a lot of them get frustrated with coverage. Like, criticism is one thing, but when journalists as well come after someone's sort of livelihood in that way and say they should be fired, I think that's actually often where ex-pros start to find it quite offensive. Like, they think that's not respectful of the work they're doing. The fact that if it's not an ex-pro saying it, if it's even, you know, worse, one of us who has never played before, saying it, then it feels like, well, you don't know what this involves. For you to come and sort of say we should get fired or get sold is not respectful, actually, of something that you don't understand at that point, is I think how a lot of them feel.
But also, like, you know, do people wanted to, like, if people want co-commentators to kind of analyze the, you know, the minutiae of the game, or like if Savage had tried to analyze United's tactics, he actually would have been silent for 90 minutes. There was none of it to speak of.
That's true. I
actually quite like Robbie on co-coms. It didn't bother me, his total lack of impartiality, but I was just making the point that some pundits with Manchester United connections are way more biased than others. Yeah.
And as I think you always said, it doesn't really matter, does it? It's,
no,
it's okay.
It really doesn't.
None of this matters. If you want something that matters, I mean, I'm not sure we're going to address anything that really matters in this podcast. Manchester United, top of the group then. Atalanta level on points with Villarreal and Young Boys. Villarreal won 4-1 at Young Boys. It was a very tight 4-1, if that makes any sense. But it was Villarreal who prevailed, and that'll do for part one. Part two will begin with Chelsea. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Chelsea 4, Malmo 0. Couple of penalties for Jorginho, Andreas Christensen with one, and Kai Havertz with one. I think everyone expected Chelsea to beat Malmo, Barry, and they did, and it was comfortable. It's more about those injuries, especially Lukaku's ankle, that really sore, didn't it?
Yeah, he looked like he did a number on it. Their next game is against Norwich, so that probably won't matter much. But longer term, maybe the rest will do him good, to be honest, because he looks like he's going to be sidelined for, I don't know, I'm guessing at least a month. And Tommy Tuchel had said in the build-up to the game that he thinks he might be mentally fatigued, and perhaps a spell on the sidelines will do him a power of good, but it's far from ideal. He was playing well last night before he went off. Malmo offered very little in the way of opposition. John Dal Thomason, their manager, has sort of did the "we're just glad to be here" chat before the game, which is fine. But it was a routine win for Chelsea. I don't think anyone was expecting much else.
It's a shame for Timo Werner to get injured when Lukaku's got injured, because you thought this might be the opportunity for Timo Werner to start scoring those buckets that I thought he'd score, despite the fact he did another very Timo Werner type miss during this game. Johnny, well, I mean, I don't know how much Chelsea you've seen this season, but I wonder how you sort of assess where they're at, because we were trying to work out on Monday if they're, which cliche they're fulfilling. Is it the, it takes a really good team to win when they're not playing brilliantly? I mean, they were good last night, but it was Malmo. Or they'll get found out eventually because they're not delivering in the same. I mean, we're talking elite level, right? We're talking compared to Man City and Liverpool.
Yeah, I mean, I saw them at Anfield, and I thought then they were pretty much nailed on for the title. They were really, really supremely good in those early weeks. I still think they'll win the title, even though they kind of, you know, they've lost essentially two strikers last night. And Werner's defenders basically say that, you know, he links really well with other players. He's got this really great understanding. And I think he kind of proved it by getting injured or in tandem with his strike partner. The interesting thing, I think, is where this leaves Chelsea, like, now, because they are, you know, having sold Tammy Abraham, it's not immediately clear who's going to play up front for them. I think Havertz can play as a sort of false nine, but there's not really much other. They had a decent, I think it's an Albanian striker called Armando Bro.
Yeah, is it Southampton? They're
not really thinking that Abraham would leave in this window. I guess the saving grace for them, as everyone knows, they have this really, really nice run of fixtures coming up. And I think it's, yeah, Norwich, and then Southampton, Saudi Arabia, and then Malmo again in the reverse leg. And then there's an international break. So you kind of assume that they'll have either Werner or Lukaku or both back by then, and you know, will probably have picked up quite a lot of points as well.
Chelsea second in the group behind Juventus, who won 1-0 at Zenit. How was that game, Nikki?
It was a rubbish game of football, but Juventus have become something which they really perhaps needed to become, because they started the season, if you remember, very, very poorly. They lost games against Empoli and Napoli. They were right down the bottom of the table, and they've sort of reasserted under Max Allegri, who's back as manager, this ability to be sort of grim and just grind out the results they need. They've won, I think, four games in a row now, 1-0. They've won more than that in the winning run, but 4 1-0s in a row, and that's kind of what they're doing. They're just being the old Juventus, who are extremely hard to break down and score the one goal they need to score. And yeah, it was 0-0 for a long time. It was a pretty uneventful match, but Dejan Kulusevski off the bench with a nice header at the end, so they got what they needed.
Into Group E, Barca beat Dinamo Kiev, and Bayern won 4-0 away at Benfica. Gerard Piqué became Barcelona's oldest ever Champions League scorer, surpassing Silvinho when he scored against Shakhtar in December 2008. Piqué is 34 years and 260 days old. I should really find out what was number one on those, so we could have a song that actually, for the first time in a long time. So when was that?
Well, while we're on the subject of Piqué, has anyone seen his balloon World Cup that he's organised?
Yes, it's amazing, isn't it? I didn't realise that I'd seen it had gone viral online, but I didn't know that Gerard Piqué was behind the Balloon World Cup. Can you explain it, Johnny?
Just another arm of Piqué Inc., like the global business conglomerate which he's building. To have basically like a cheese dream or you know, be messing around one night and just be able to turn that into this global viral sensation. But yeah, I mean,
do you reckon him and Shakira and the kids were just gadding around the house one day with balloons and he had a light bulb moment?
That's basically
the light bulb went off over his head and he thought it was a balloon and went to swat it.
The idea is that you two players against each other, and if the balloon hits the ground, you lose, basically. So and
we've all played it. Surely you've played. I've played this game. I just never thought of monetizing the damn thing. You know, I wouldn't be here.
I love that there's like a living room they do it in, like a big living room. But there seems to be a car in it.
You didn't grow up with a car in your living room, you know, like someone
sure
had just driven through the front, driven through the front room. Anyway, Steve Silk Hurley with Jack Your Body was number one. I don't know what that song is. When Gerard Piqué was born on the 2nd of February 1987. Does anyone feel like I'm kind of supporting Barcelona and treating them as underdogs in every football match they're in at the moment, even if it's completely incorrect. They may not have been underdogs yesterday. I just presume that, you know, that it's basically like supporting a non-league side in the first round of the FA Cup every time they turn out onto the pitch.
Yeah, there's a sort of pathos to them at the moment, which you saw it also with United, like in the kind of during the Moyes era and the immediate aftermath of the Moyes era, when they kind of plummeted so dramatically, that there is this kind of vertigo, and you do feel sorry for them a little bit, and like, because you're just so used to seeing Barcelona, you know, winning things and being dominant and being kind of, you know, having that sort of swagger to them. From what I saw, like, the Nou Camp looked quite empty and sullen and forlorn. I suppose you could call it underdog energy, even though they are still, you know, one of the richest clubs in the world in theory, in terms of assets, not in terms of cash flow.
Just watching that game yesterday with so few people in the Nou Camp, I couldn't help but notice, because it's normally full, so you don't get to see the seats, but they're very faded. And it reminded me of Sunderland before they put in the new red seats. They had these sun bleached pinky white seats, which just look really indicative of a great club's decline. Now, I'm not comparing Sunderland and Barcelona, but I think the first thing they need to do as they try to, you know, become a force again is replace the seats.
How much is a seat? Because, I mean, I don't know how much money they've got, but they've got 100,000 seats, haven't they?
Yeah, I don't know. I remember Sunderland got fans in to do it, so they got it done.
Bring your own seat, the sort of mismatch of different seats.
No, I think they provided the seats, but the fans had to bring their own screwdrivers.
Blimey. Okay, well, look, good luck. Good luck to plucky little Barcelona. Yeah. Let's see if they can make it through. They're third in the table behind Benfica, who lost 4-0 at home to Bayern Munich. It wasn't entirely straightforward, but Leroy Sané scored a couple, including an absolutely beautiful free kick. So well done to him. And Group G, the Salzburg, Sevilla, Lille, Wolfsburg group, which is a sort of... seems odd that it's a Champions League group, doesn't it? But I think Lars was telling me last night, Salzburg, I think 9 of their outfield players were under 24. They've just got one 35-year-old left-back who presumably doesn't like the music in the dressing room. He's sort of wondering what all these young people are doing. But that's quite extraordinary. And they are top of that group. 7 points from 3 games. Sevilla are second. They drew 0-0 with Lille, who are third, and Wolfsburg are fourth.
We're somehow halfway through that group, and Salzburg are the only team that's actually won a game. Everyone's just drawn.
It doesn't make any sense, does it? I don't know, that mathematically can't have worked. You're right. The other Italian sides that played on Tuesday that we didn't discuss in detail, particularly, Nicky, Inter won and Milan lost. Give us their sort of Champions League status.
Yeah, Milan obviously are pretty hard to come back from here. No points after 3 games, though, of course, Atalanta did do it a couple of seasons ago. I feel quite sorry for Milan. They were bad against Porto. They've had a lot of injuries and then COVID that sort of really undermined them before this game. I think this game came at a bad time, which I feel bad for them just because it's such a tough group. And I actually thought they played really well against Liverpool. Against Atletico, they played really well despite losing Frank Kessie to a red card very early. And it feels like they've missed their opportunity in those 2 games, and then they've run out of steam at the wrong time. But who knows? Because Milan are right up there competing right now at the top of Serie A with Napoli in terms of the early pace setters. So could even be one of those seasons where they'll end up being happy if they do go out of Europe early and can concentrate on what could be an amazing league campaign. That's very premature to say that, but it's a thought that's in my head. Inter managed to win, which was really all that they most centrally needed against Sheriff. And of course, no one else has beaten Sheriff yet in that group, so it's something. But their European performances remain fairly unconvincing to me. And they were 1-0 up and managed to get to let that lead slip. And you started to think this is going to be another of those Inter nights in Europe, which have been a repeat theme of disappointment in recent seasons. But they did it this time. Managed to see it out and come back and get the win. So a necessary win for them. I think Milan, it would take several miracles now for Milan to get out of that group. Whereas Inter, with that win, you think, okay, there's a path again.
Just while we're on Serie A, did you expect Milan and Napoli to be the front runners?
Well, my pre-season column for The Guardian did list Napoli as a dark horse. I can't say I expected them to win 8 out of 8. That's their joint best start ever they've had in Serie A. I'm absolutely head over heels in love with Victor Osimhen as a footballer right now. And I think that anyone who hasn't been checking out what he's been doing is missing something, because he's just wonderful. He's huge. He's 6'4", but he's, without wanting to fall back on the good touch for a big man cliches, he's really a superior footballer. Like, you watch the way he uses his body to shield opponents, to keep opponents out of the way, and then the subtlety of his touch. I think some English fans got a glimpse of it in the game against Leicester already in the Europa League, but he's been doing that week after week for Napoli. Milan are definitely on an upwards trajectory. And I'll say again, I think even in the Champions League, they've played well, actually. But they've got the third youngest team in all of Serie A. They started, obviously, last season really well. We're on top of Serie A. I think they were top at the halfway point last season, and then struggled a bit in the second half. So they've got to show that this young group has got a bit more durability in it, I guess, than last season, because they did start very well last season. For Napoli, the big concern, actually, I think the big concern for Napoli might be the Africa Cup of Nations right in the middle of the season, because they're going to say goodbye to Koulibaly, to Osimhen, who I've just been praising, and Anguissa, of course, who's come in from Fulham and has been a bit of a revelation, actually. He's been really, really solid for them in midfield. So that's actually the thing which I keep looking at for Napoli and thinking, if they can get through that when it comes along, then we'll see if they're really capable of going all the way this season.
Let's talk about Leicester City. You mentioned their 4-3 victory against Spartak. Patson Daka scoring 4 goals, Johnny.
He did. And they were all kind of off-piece, pretty much. You know, he was just kind of sit on the shoulder of the last man. And they just you know, kept playing through balls to him. And he kept running onto them. And he kept finishing. So, yeah, I mean, they actually have a real kind of wealth of options up front now. Leicester, considering that, you know, maybe this time last year we were talking about what are they going to do when Jamie Vardy, you know, finally turns 40, or and, you know, how are they going to replace him? And it seems like they do have a load of different options on the table now, which bodes well for them. And it was a really good game, of which I saw some minutes. I can't say, but also the slightly agreeable sensation of like just having football on at 3 p.m. Was it 3 p.m. like 3:30 on a Wednesday?
Mm-hmm.
Quite nice. Like that. All in favour of like football games at random times in the middle of the week.
I hear you on the odd occasion, but there can be none on a Saturday or Sunday night. You know, the Antiques Roadshow time is Antiques Roadshow time. I mean, obviously for me, they're all a stupid hour of the day, but I'm just trying to pretend. While we're on Patson Daka, we had an email from Zambia. After he scored against Manchester United. Chisanga said, "Hi Max, Baz and everyone else. I'm writing to you from Zambia, and after seeing Patson Daka become the first ever Zambian scorer in the Premier League, I figured it's a great time to let you know that you're extremely popular here in Zambia. My friends and I never miss an episode, and as a selfish fan, I was disappointed you didn't spend 45 minutes of the pod talking about his last minute slightly scuffed tap-in that didn't change the outcome of the game. It deserved a whole special episode, lol," says Chisanga. "I love the pod. Thanks for keeping it running smoothly, even with your big move down under." Barry, we need to pencil in Zambia when we do our live world tour. Are you in?
Yeah, why not?
Excellent news. Chisanga, if you could put us up, or like come back to us, let us know who you're prepared to put up, given what you know about us, and we'll bring that panel along. And that'll do for part two. Part three will begin with Steve Bruce's shock departure from Newcastle United. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Steve Bruce has left Newcastle by mutual consent. He said there had been highs and lows, and hoped the new owners could take the club forward. He's understood to have got $8 million payoff after his contract was paid up in full. "I think it might be my last job. It's been very, very tough," he said in an interview with The Telegraph. "To never really be wanted, to feel that people wanted me to fail and saying I would fail, that I was a useless, fat waste of space, a tactically inept cabbage head." It's interesting, actually. We sort of talk about the working environment. We talk about the payoff as well. But it can't have been easy. That doesn't mean he was doing a great job, Baz, but it must have been a difficult situation for him.
Yes, of course. No one wants to be abused by the fans of the club they're managing. He was never really given a chance. They didn't want him in the first place. Straight off the bat, he didn't do a good job, but he didn't do the terrible job many Newcastle fans claim either. If you look at his record at Newcastle and you look at Rafa Benitez's, who Newcastle fans all love, if you look at their records, they're remarkably similar. Number of points, number of wins. It's 90 points each, 23 wins for Bruce, 24 for Rafa. Goals scored, 84 for Bruce, 81 for Rafa. Goals conceded, 120 Bruce, 95 Rafa. Two remarkably similar records over a similar length of time in the Premier League. One of them is hailed as a genius and the other is ridiculed and abused and called a cabbage head. That seems slightly unfair to me. But again, he didn't do a particularly good job. Last season, they finished 13th. They had the 13th highest wage bill. 13th is where they should finish. That's exactly par. Now, if you're a golfer, par is a decent round. It's not going to win you any tournaments if you get par every round. But it's going to keep you on the tour. Obviously, he had to go. Newcastle United fans are delighted he's gone. They now have got everything they want. Ashley gone, Bruce gone, new owners. It will be interesting to see what they find to complain about next, because they will certainly find something to complain about. Probably that defense of Steve Bruce that I've just said.
It went further than the results, though. You know, they finished 12th and 13th, and they've been pretty poor this season. And, you know, with the caveat that I think a lot of the criticism of Bruce was kind of a proxy for something else. You know, it was a kind of a broader despondency that he became this lightning rod for. But equally, the football was bad. The football was really bad. We can say that, you know, Bruce did a decent job on his own terms, which are, you know, really quite limited, whilst completely rejecting the notion that Newcastle, you know, fans, I guess, or that a club like Newcastle should really be agreeing to hire a manager on those terms. The point is not that Steve Bruce did a bad job, but that Steve Bruce shouldn't really have been in that job because of the kind of manager that he is, and the sort of football that we know his teams have played in the past, and we kind of knew he was going to play with Newcastle. He sort of did exactly what everyone expected, which I think is kind of what Newcastle fans feared when he was taken on. And I think if there had been fans in the stadium, last season and the end of the season before, I think it would have got a lot more toxic a lot earlier. Clearly, he's a nice bloke, and you know, I know that because his friends in the media keep telling me that he's a really nice bloke. But
I've met Steve Bruce, and he was lovely. I've met him a couple of times, and he was really nice. And I'm not just saying that because I want some of his 8 million payoff. Do you know what? I did have this thought. I think I sort of had a sort of weird daydream. I was having a nap. I have a lot of naps these days. And I was sort of thinking about, what if when I was at university, I just decided I'm going to be a football manager, right? And I'd done all my badges and I'd be one of those, he never played the game, but he's a student of the game type football manager.
Villas Boas, right?
Yeah, I could have been that, because I reckon I could have been as sort of tactically boring as Steve Bruce and now have £8 million. I don't know if it logically works like that. A question on Newcastle. We've talked about it a lot, and I've written a column about human rights, which, I don't know if it's good or not, but just almost about, we all talked about it last week. Like, we talked about it, Monday Night Football talked about it, Match of the Day sort of mentioned it. And you suspect that all of us, to varying degrees, will kind of stop talking about it now. Like, oh, you know, we've done our job. We've said human rights are important and some countries have bad human rights records. And now most of the time, because we're a football podcast, even more for them, they're a highlight show or a live football show, they won't talk about it again. How should we continue to cover that part of Newcastle United? And also, you know, how guilty have we been of not talking about it, about PSG and Manchester City and those state ownerships? Because I feel I've sort of let it slip because I don't put an asterisk every time we talk about Manchester City, for example. I don't know what you think, Johnny.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, there's a kind of, I don't know, I suppose you call it like a really fundamentalist strain of social media out there that demands that, for example, you know, if you're writing an Atletico match report, you should always refer to him as Luis Suarez, the racist, pass the ball into the area. And there is that kind of, there is that strand of thought that you shouldn't ever really, you know, mention Newcastle or PSG without, you know, on some level acknowledging what's behind it. And I'm not sure like I 100% subscribe to that, because like it is a really tough question, and I'm gonna come clean. I don't really know the answer. I'm still really grappling with this myself, so I don't have anything, you know, insightful to offer really. But I just think that there is a kind of an element of separating the art from the artist here, compartmentalizing what happens on the pitch and what's happening off the pitch, and where it's all, and the forces, the political and the economic forces that go into making football what it is, whilst acknowledging those links. I think it's kind of an enlightened and mature thing to do. People can sort of make up their own minds on what matters to them and like how much they want to care about the various facets of the game. And I think, you know, the job of us is not to just keep hammering away at it like it's some kind of polemical exercise, but just making sure people are informed, making sure people, like, I think everyone knows that, you know, Newcastle are owned by Saudi Arabia and Saudi Arabia have a terrible human rights record. I think the media has done a pretty decent job on that in part. And just, you know, just kind of making sure that doesn't get buried. You know, you don't have to keep hammering on about it every time we talk about Newcastle. But, you know, just making sure it's still there and people can access that information if they want to know more.
Yeah, and just on that Suarez thing, he, of course, denied all the allegations of racism made against him.
Paulo Fonseca is in talks with Newcastle United.
They could do a lot of good for their public image by, I don't know, appointing maybe Emma Hayes. That would really put the cat among the pigeons, although I suspect she wouldn't take the job.
Who knows? I mean, Fonseca is... Would that be good, Nikki?
I like some of what he did at Roma. I think he's had a... Obviously, he had a good time at Shakhtar before that as well. At Roma, the knock on him was that he created a team that played some attractive football. He did some good stuff as a sort of ambitious, high-line kind of approach to the game. But at Roma, despite spending a lot of the season either in or very close to the Champions League spots, ultimately lost all of their big games. They kept losing the big games. I think they couldn't beat anyone inside the top seven, I think it was, all season. So that was the knock on him at Roma, which I suppose is not such an immediate concern for Newcastle. They're not necessarily thinking right away that they expect a new manager to come and take them straight into the top four. But I suppose with time and money, who knows?
Newcastle United have this week suggested their fans, while their new owners were not offended by fans finding whatever they could to dress in traditional Arab dress, to not do it as it may be culturally inappropriate. Whoever the social media manager of Newcastle United is, they're in a tricky spot right now on all number of things. You know, Premier League this weekend. Yeah, Manchester United Liverpool is the big game. We obviously talked about Manchester United in detail. We talked about Liverpool. You think 0-0, Johnny? It has been 0-0 many times, hasn't it? It's going to, what are Sky calling it? Super red, mega red, red, red Sunday. Is that what it is this Sunday?
Oh, I saw them call it like the most watched club game in world football. Yeah, it'll be 0-0. No, it might not. Yeah, Liverpool might tear them apart, but I certainly don't think United will play anything like as open as they did last night.
Do you want an update on Mauro Icardi, Barry?
Yes, please.
People were very excited at the job you did explaining what had happened in his love life recently. Roy Nemer, who is a football journalist, tweeted yesterday, say, Mauro Icardi has unfollowed every account on Instagram, including PSG. The only account he now follows is his wife, Wanda. So he can't be his scrolling is going to be quite limited now. Unless, of course, he has another account, you know, should just check, you know, I don't know, if he's got an alias, maybe. Trevor says, I'm watching Married at First Sight Australia under protest, I should add. Barry did such a good job explaining Mauro and Wanda's issues. Can you get him to summarise MAFS, as he calls it, so I don't have to pay attention to it? Are you aware of Married at First Sight, Barry?
I'm aware of it, but I've never seen it.
Oh, it's quite incredible.
I watched a full season of it, and then I found out, disappointingly, that, like, none of them actually, like... seem to last very long. And it's, yeah.
That's the problem. You don't get married and then have to spend at least 30 years together to see how it goes. You can annul it after like 4 weeks. So essentially you have a weird party with a group of people you don't know. Then you have a honeymoon with someone you don't know. And then you say, I don't like this person because I don't know who they are. And this is not a usual way of getting together. I think The Bachelor is the one I hate the most. I find The Bachelor just infuriates me. Where, you know, a man is put in a house with 30 models, or a woman is put in a house with 30 models, and then they obviously can't find love because their eyes are getting turned. Well, no shit. You're in and everybody falls in love. Like, all the 30 people fall in love with that person. I mean, how can they all? Surely someone just thinks that that person is a dick and doesn't want to marry them, but they all want to marry them. Oh, Christ. Absolutely.
I think there's a spin-off podcast coming, Max.
Joel says, Dear Football Weekly, I used to work for the fact-checking organisation Full Fact. Barry was recently pulled
up. Did he? We should probably do some research on that.
That's a very good point. But Barry was recently picked up on it because he got something wrong about HGV drivers reversing, although we weren't sure if he got anything wrong. And actually, as a follow-up to that, Full Fact were very excited that Barry had admitted his mistake, or kind of had, but the government hadn't. And it was something like, if football podcasts can do it, why can't the government? I used to work for the fact-checking organisation Full Fact, was delighted to hear their recent intervention on the show, a crossover of worlds which I never expected. I'm afraid to say it has, however, prompted me to bring another recent factual issue on the pod to light. You stated on Tuesday's show that no babies born this year were given the name Philippe. That's not necessarily true. For confidentiality reasons, the Office of National Statistics does not publish annual baby names in England or Wales if they were given to only one or two babies. It follows that up to two babies this year, in fact, may have been given the name Philippe. I'll be the first to admit this is not an egregious error, but the knowledge that Philippe may not be an entirely extinct name in England and Wales may offer a morsel of comfort to Monsieur Auclair and his teapot. So too might the fact that 92 baby boys were given the name Philippe in France in 2020. That is very kind. Thanks for getting in touch. We appreciate that. Gabriel says, have you seen Kevin Keegan's latest awards ceremony appearance? You'll remember he hosted the Meat Processing Awards, and he was asked in a Q&A what he thought the meat industry had coped with the pandemic. He came up with a very good answer. He 2 days ago hosted the Multimodal Awards, recognizing excellent in air, road, rail, maritime and freight forwarding services, voted by the thousands of readers of the Multimodal newsletter and exhibitors and visitors to Multimodal. Kevin Keegan was not asked anything. It was £1,750 for a table of 10. Pre-dinner drinks reception, three-course dinner with wine, entertainment with Kevin Keegan, plus after party. So Kevin is doing a rich trade. He did a keynote speech, did Kevin, about freight.
Those corporate gigs, comedians hate them and invariably bomb at them, but they're very well paid. So that's why they take the gig. Kevin Keegan's under no pressure, really, to be funny because he's not a comedian. So it's a nice, easy gig for him.
Absolutely right. We should all try and get on that train. No one would expect us to be funny.
I'm guessing, Max, you've done your fair share of corporates back in the day.
I've done a few. The strangest thing I got paid to do was take over the Twitter account of Carphone Warehouse for an hour. And I don't know why. And I just, you know, I was like, I've taken over the Carphone Warehouse from now. Have you got any questions? And people had questions about their phones that weren't working. And I just said, have you tried switching it off and switching it on again? And Carphone Warehouse lost quite a few followers. And then I got paid. I'm very happy to do that kind of work. Parkgate Football Club tweeted, tonight's man of the match voted by Parkgate fan of over 20 years, Martin, is Tim Whittaker. This is in the Toolstation Northern Counties East Football League. Tim receives, and there's a photo of this, an official unwrapped 2002 Sugar Babes album, Angels with Dirty Faces. Roundwood, baby, round, round, it says. What a wonderful prize for becoming man of the match. Brad's been in touch. I very much enjoyed last pod's rug discussion. I write this because I suspect I have overpaid the most for a rug in history of rug purchasing. The year was 2014 and list price of the rug was $490. But the company offered a £5 discount to pay in Bitcoin. So I did. That 0.9 Bitcoin is now worth $55,630.89. I attach a screenshot of the confirmation email as proof, says Brad. Thank you very much. Sorry, Brad. Sorry to hear that, mate. Regarding your teapot, Barry, and the hidden track from yesterday, I don't know if you heard this, Nicky or Johnny, but Barry was suggesting that when he's been lucky on a night out, he has suggested that anyone who's come back to his place is amazed when he serves them tea made in a pot. And he says that's the secret, although... you know, proof would suggest perhaps otherwise. Our mate Barca Jim, is there any particular pattern for the teapot that Baz would recommend? And Brendan asks, is a teapot still considered sexy with a cozy on it?
I don't have a tea cozy. There's no pattern on it. But it's also important to have a little jug as well on the side for the milk rather than pouring it out of a carton or a bottle.
I don't like pots of tea. You never need that much tea, and the tea gets cold. But I mean, that hence the cozy, I guess. But also, it gets too strong, and you end up with varying strength of tea. Mm. And I want everybody, sharing the pot of tea to have, you know, the same strength of tea. Kind of an article of faith for me.
I can't disagree more with you never need that much tea, but the rest of that's right.
Either way, would either of you be impressed if you woke up in Barry's house and he made you tea in a box? That's the question. It's not something either of you seem to want to
If I was ever in a situation where I woke up one morning in Barry's house, I think tea would be the very least of my demands.
Alex says, will you ask Bazinator if he'd meet two huge fans of the pod for a pint in Brixton on Friday evening?
I think this guy sent me an email.
Okay.
And I was discussing with a mate yesterday how... I don't think it's a good idea.
I should say that lots of people in Australia have invited me for a drink. Like, I've been sort of inundated and I haven't said yes to anybody. And I don't know about you, Barrett. It's not because I feel... It's not because I don't want to, but I just want my meetings to be organic. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. You're just rude, Max. You think you're better than them.
I don't think I am. I'm also quite busy in the
evening. I just worry about meeting strangers for a pint because what if I don't like them? or they don't like me? So, you know, have a good weekend in Brixton, lads. If I bump into you, great. But I have plans.
That'll do for today. I hope you've had a lovely time. Thank you, Nikki. Thank you for your time.
Thanks.
Thanks, Johnny.
Thanks.
Thanks, Baz.
You're welcome. Sorry, one little tiny point.
Yes, yes.
I really don't want to meet anyone for a pint if they're going to call me the Bazinator. I mean, we've already got off on the wrong foot.
Me and the Bazinator will be back on Monday.
This is The Guardian.